This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.pardes.org.
Hi, this is David Levenkris. Welcome to another edition of This Pardes Life. As you know, we've been speaking about the three secular values according to Sherwin Wine. And today we're going to be looking at the whole issue of survival. I'm speaking to Meir Schweiger. And Meir, I'd like to ask you, is survival a Jewish value?
David, I definitely think survival is a Jewish value. And I think that it's rooted in two ideas which are central to Judaism. One is the value of life, and the other one is continuity. And I can just speak on a personal level from my mother, who was a Holocaust survivor. She did everything to remain alive. During the time of the Holocaust, she was actually, for a period of 6 months, she was hiding in the forest just outside of her town, and to the point where it was, this is Poland, in December, and she had a short sleeve dress, and somehow she managed to keep alive. And I think perhaps the thing which even pushed her to do everything to remain alive was a sense of continuity, that somehow she felt that it was important to not only stay alive for herself, but also to continue, okay, for her family that she knew was pretty much liquidated during the final Aktion, the action that the Germans carried out when they entered their town.
Mary, that's a very powerful story that you shared, and thank you very, very much for sharing. I'm interested, nonetheless, in pushing you on it a little bit, and that is, I hear your mother's indomitable will to survive, but what is the purpose of that survival? Do you believe, for example, that survival just for its own sake is of value? And I'm trying not to lead the witness, but is there value, let's say, in Jews surviving, or does it need to be more than that?
Ultimately, I think that survival is not a value in and of itself. I mean, I think survival is in order to actualize values. And if we're speaking about from a Jewish perspective, the Torah says in Leviticus, "Vachai bahem," that you shall live by the laws of the Torah. And it says, "Vachai bahem," and the rabbis interpreted, "Velo sheyamut bahem," that you shall not die by them, which means that if a person is confronted with the choice of violating a mitzvah, okay, or remaining alive, for example, if we need to drive someone to the hospital on Shabbat in a life-threatening situation, then according to the Torah, then you need to violate Shabbat in order to save that person's life. But the logic behind it is because by saving their life, they ultimately will be able to continue observing Shabbat and to be doing more mitzvot, more commandments, so that, yes, life is a value, but then that raises another question, towards what end? And life by itself is not a value. Life is a value in order for people to actualize their human dignity, to actualize their being in the image of God.
That's really beautiful. Thank you again for sharing that with me and with us. I'm wondering, though, it's not always as simple and clear as that. Sometimes people are in situations where they have to do things that are maybe morally problematic or in which they have to give up on certain values. Particularly, how far can I go against some Platonic ideal of what my values should be in order to survive?
Well, if we're looking at the Bible, I think you have, two very interesting stories that come up. One story is Abraham, who this is chapter 12 in Genesis, where during a time of famine, Abraham goes down to Egypt and he passes off his wife Sarah as being his sister. And in fact, before they actually go to Egypt, Abraham says to her, "Please do me this favor to say that you're my sister rather than my wife," with the assumption that he's making that if he were to say that she's his wife, that he will be killed, and that somehow by lying, okay, he will be able to remain alive. Now, if we assume that this actually is a model for us, and this is the basis of a lot of discussion, but certainly according to quite a few rabbis, rabbinical interpretations of this passage, what Abraham did was actually was legitimate and was proactive. He was doing everything which he possibly could to deal with a difficult, okay, crisis situation, and that the way it would be put is that he's not lying, but he's actually telling a half-truth. And this actually comes across in chapter 20, in a second story, where Abraham is in a different place, right? Different characters, but the same line. He's in the land of the Philistines, and once again, he says, "This is my sister," and Sarah is taken by the king. And then when he's confronted with the fact that he's lied, so Abraham's response is that, but in fact, she really is my half-sister. Okay, so, but obviously, he was not telling the full truth, and not only that, but clearly he was saying it in such a way that was misleading, and eventually led to a very problematic situation. Now, if I look at another example, which I think is actually very, very interesting, that is Jacob. When Jacob is running away from his brother who wants to kill him, and he goes to his uncle, Laban. What we see in this whole story when Jacob is by Laban is that Laban, from beginning to end, does everything to trick Jacob, to exploit him. And yet what we find in that situation is how Jacob, to the very end, maintains his integrity and feels that this is something which is a critical principle for him, that he will not survive based on a lie. It's especially striking since the same Jacob is the person who stole the brothers from his, stole the blessings, excuse me, from his brother Esav, okay, masquerading as his brother. So one could say that in this moment of truth, Jacob actually feels that, in other words, he has to maintain his integrity. So what I would say is that there certainly is a basis for perhaps not what we would call today full disclosure, where you're trying to survive. Probably the best example of this is in a story that appears in the book of Samuel, when God tells Samuel that he would like to have him go and anoint David to be the king. And then Samuel says, but if Saul finds out, he will kill me. So how can I explain to him that I went to this place? And God basically says, well, just say that, in other words, you're going to offer certain sacrifices, which means that even God proposed to Samuel to basically fabricate a story in order to save his life. Okay, now, all the examples which I gave had to do with, as I said, lying or perhaps not full disclosure. Okay, we don't necessarily find other types of quote-unquote crimes that would be legitimate, okay, that would justify remaining alive. And in fact, I would just say, since I mentioned earlier about my mother, there have been quite a few situations of, because of perhaps my mother, where I have had contact with many Holocaust survivors, and I've heard numerous stories of people who told me of situations where there was tremendous starvation, shortage of food, and where people would be extremely careful to not steal from other people because they felt that by stealing they would be somehow losing their human dignity, and that ultimately this is a very real tension, which is, on the one hand, I have this drive to survive, but at a certain point it might be that I pay a price, then the process of surviving, I lose my human dignity. And I think that there is certainly a very good basis to say that there are lines which people cannot cross, okay, in order to survive. As you find in the Talmud, that the rabbis say that there are three cardinal sins, where if somebody is told, give up your life or be killed, that a person has to be prepared to give up their life. One is idolatry, one is sexual immorality, and the other one is murder. So I think, yes, survival, there is room to say that there may be certain things that could be done in the course of surviving. But I would also say from the examples that we have, that I think the general thrust is that a person should do everything to maintain their dignity and on that basis survive. As you asked earlier, survival towards what end? Well, if I've compromised my principles and then remain alive, is it really worth being alive after having compromised my principles? What value is there to my life?
Can you give some examples of modern actions which you think are within the realm of acceptability, but nevertheless might be permitted in order to survive?
Well, I would just say that as someone who's been living in Israel for quite a while, and especially because I think of the bad press which Israel gets, and also as someone who was 20 years in the Israeli army and has six sons who have been and continue to be in the Israeli army, I think that in Israel we face all kinds of situations of survival when we're attacked. And I think that it raises a very real question of, you know, how do we respond to that? And even take something which we're experiencing right now in terms of, you know, the question of knife stabbing and of being run over by cars. And, you know, you have a basic question of, well, so how do I look when I have somebody who's not Jewish? And let's be very specific, someone who is Arab, do I suspect them? Do I immediately jump the gun? How far am I willing to perhaps wait to have absolutely conclusive evidence and feel that there's, you know, there's no way that I'm going to survive before I defend myself? Or what point is it that, in other words, that maybe I have to, you know, see my defense as being something which is paramount, and maybe I don't have the luxury of dealing with this question in a kind of ivory tower, but I need to actually have an immediate response, which unfortunately in some cases could have tragic results. And we have seen, for example, in Israel where there was an Eritrean man who was killed because he was suspected of being a terrorist. So that I think that, you know, when people are in situations of where they have to make split-minute decisions, okay, that sometimes you, as I said, you have to make certain choices. And by the same token, even if it's not a split-minute decision, but I think that what, you know, is an issue, I think, in Western countries, what's called racial profiling, I think maybe that's something that perhaps needs to be done in some cases, which we do reluctantly, but at the same time, the alternative is that if we're not careful, then we may be dead.
I just want to point out that that same incident at the Be'er Sheva bus station, there actually was an Israeli soldier who was also killed by friendly fire, which I think really highlights some of the difficult moral situation that people are put in when they have to make decisions without full knowledge. And I think that maybe even heightens this whole idea of making hard decisions that sometimes have tragic results, but nevertheless one does the best that one can when one is under a situation. Which leads us to speak to another type of a survival, which I think the Tanakh and Judaism in general are very good at dealing with, and that is surviving personal tragedy. Rahmana Litzlan, the family of this Eritrean worker, or the family of the soldier who was killed, or any tragedy that we have, I'm interested to hear your insights about what the Tanakh has to teach us about surviving personal tragedy.
Well, as in true Jewish fashion, I think what you see in the Tanakh are different responses. And, you know, I think the question is, it's a very, I would say, charged emotionally. And I would also say that without being judgmental, you know, in terms of which is the right thing to do. But I'll give one example that you have is in the book of Leviticus. On the day where the tabernacle is installed, the beginning of the functioning of the tabernacle, we're told of this moment where Aaron brings sacrifices, and then all of a sudden there's fire which comes down from heaven, and everybody is in a state of ecstasy. And at that very moment, all of a sudden, Aaron's sons bring what's called strange fire, incense, which they weren't commanded to do. And then fire comes out from God and they're killed. And here is Aaron, who at this moment, okay, he is the person representing the Jewish people. He is, you might even say this is the moment of his glory when he is now installed as being the high priest. And it's a very celebratory moment. And all of a sudden, his sons are killed. Aaron's response is silence. It says, Aaron, Vayidom Aharon, he is silent. This is chapter 10 in Leviticus. And that's one response. Okay, now, we could say that, you know, Aaron's response to this tragedy was shock. But certainly the way the rabbis understand it is that it was a kind of acceptance, perhaps. And the idea being, and it was, in fact, if we continue reading it, it seems to be he has a very reasoned response that he's prepared to continue with the various sacrifices that need to be brought, okay, that are absolutely essential. He's not prepared to do those things which are not essential. And I think, at least in giving this example, there's a very interesting perhaps tension between someone who's an individual versus somebody who's a public figure. And I would just say that perhaps from this we see that there are various times when one who is a public figure perhaps has to somehow put to the side their personal tragedy for the good of the nation, and that they have to be prepared to somehow continue on because the nation needs them. If I took another example that we have in the Tanakh, Abraham, when his wife dies, when Sarah dies, that is a very powerful, okay, tragedy for Abraham. And the reason why I say that is because it's the only instance where we have any description of emotions, or at least negative emotions on the part of Abraham, where it says that Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. And I could imagine this as a moment in Abraham's life where Sarah is literally his soulmate. And his whole journey, she has accompanied him. And now all of a sudden to lose her, okay, is a very devastating moment. And yet we find that after she dies, the text actually says Abraham gets up. It's as if Abraham has to now put himself together. And then what you find is that he engages in extensive negotiations with the people around him in order to not only bury his wife, but ultimately to do what would be considered the first acquisition of land and basically establishing a foothold for the Jewish people in the land of Israel. This might also be an example of someone who is, although he's not a leader, but he perhaps has a historic mission. And at that moment where Abraham is very much caught up with his personal loss, he at the same moment also realizes, but this is perhaps something which can impact on the future of his children, and therefore Abraham somehow, again, puts to the side his personal loss in order to be able to then do an act, which is acquiring a burial plot, which then becomes, as I said, the foothold of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. There's a third example, which I think is probably the most human response, and that is Jacob. When Joseph is sent by Jacob to find his brothers, and then afterwards, the brothers sell Joseph, but then they somehow try to cover that up, and they take his coat and they dip it in blood, send it to Jacob. And Jacob is convinced that Joseph is dead. What you see from that section is at that moment, Jacob's life is put on hold. Jacob ceases to function. And it's especially striking because later on in the book of Bereishit, when Joseph eventually reveals himself and tells the brothers to go back and tell Jacob that he's alive, when the brothers come back and say that, it says, "Vatechi ruach Yaakov avihem," that the spirit of Jacob comes alive. And then all of a sudden you see how Jacob becomes very, very active. The reason why I bring this up is, once again, somebody who's been living in Israel, it's actually something which, unfortunately, I would say, on the one hand, thank God I've never experienced directly in my own personal life, but I certainly have seen this in terms of friends and neighbors, that there are some people who, when they have a child or they have some close relative who has been killed in a war or killed in a terror attack, for some people that totally shatters their life. And then it's as if they can no longer function. And there are some people who just are constantly caught up with somehow either memorializing the memory of the person who is killed, or in some cases going to the grave of the person, and it's as if no matter what else was going on in their life has actually now come to an end, and it really is all about the person who was just killed. And there are other people who I've seen who, with all the pain which they have, they somehow continue to make a life for themselves, and not only that, but they take that pain and they then transform it into a lever to be able to actually bring much more good in the world. So that, for example, the people who have experienced personal tragedy then make it a kind of cause to go and visit other people who've had tragedies, to actually help other people somehow put their lives back together. And as I said, this is something which is very, very personal. I certainly would not put any judgment on anyone, and I think that we have models for both types of reactions. I'll just say something that once actually made an unbelievable impression on me. When I was growing up, I was in my teens, I had the merit of actually listening to classes given by Rabbi Soloveitchik, in particular classes that he gave in memory of his wife, who had just, in fact, passed away. And they were absolutely brilliant, and I was riveted for hours listening to him. And there were moments during the class where he would speak about his wife. And the way that he spoke, you could see the pain that he experienced, the tremendous sense of loss which he had, the vacuum that was created in his life. And yet, what I felt at the time was that there was that element, but nevertheless, he was able to somehow take that and to then be able to channel it in a way which was to give inspirational classes to thousands of students around him. So I think I would say for myself that I would hope that, in other words, in situations where I would experience difficult, very difficult situations, that I would find the inner strength to be able to actually affirm life and to be able to somehow take my losses and to transform it into bringing better good into the world.
We've spoken about personal survival, we've spoken about national survival, we've spoken about surviving personal tragedy. Of course, as Jews, there's another kind of survival, and that is the survival of the Jewish people, especially but not only in the diaspora. There's a famous story from the marvelous book, The Jew and the Lotus, when Rabbi Yitz Greenberg says to the Dalai Lama, "Can you teach me to levitate?" And the Dalai Lama says to him, "Yes," he says, "if you can teach me how to survive for 2,000 years in the diaspora," highlighting that our survival really in some way is a miracle. I'm interested, Meir, in your insights as to how and why we somehow managed to survive against all odds for 2,000 years.
Okay, maybe I'll start with something which probably people would not expect. When Abraham was 99 years old and God told him that he was going to have a son, so Abraham fell on his face and he laughed. And then what God said to him was, "And you shall call this child Yitzchak," which literally means "he will laugh." And I would say that in a certain sense, that sets the stage for the Jewish people. And that's probably why you have a disproportionate number of Jews who are comedians. That Jewish people somehow seem to have this ability to laugh at their situation and to be able to have this optimism which keeps them through the most difficult situations. So that I think, you know, being able to laugh and is a key factor, okay? And sometimes we would even call it black humor, right? That keeps us going. But on another level, I would say two things. One of the things which I think kept the Jewish people going was a vision of something better. And to be more specific, for Jews who are in the diaspora, the idea of next year in Jerusalem. And this hope, this aspiration of no matter what we find ourselves in right now, but eventually, right, we have this messianic belief that we will make it to Jerusalem and ultimately we will create a much better reality. That's something which I think was absolutely essential. But I would say there's also another aspect to it, which is not just looking to the future, but perhaps what really enables me to look to the future is also to be able to look to the past and to perhaps get inspiration from the past. There's a very interesting story in the Torah. When Joseph is in Egypt, after he's been sold as a slave, and Joseph is all alone, and he's really in what we would call he's become even assimilated within Egyptian culture. And there's a certain moment where the wife of his master, Mrs. Potiphar, attempts to seduce Joseph, and Joseph says no. He absolutely refuses. And there's a rabbinic comment that says that at that moment, Joseph saw the image of his father before him. And he said, "I can't do this." And I think that there is something about Jews in the diaspora who at a certain point perhaps draw on their past. In some cases, it could be on your immediate family, perhaps your grandparents, or sometimes it could be just, as I said, the Jewish past. And that somehow says to you, you know what, you have a past which is very important that you need to be perpetuating. And I think that that's something which can be a very, very powerful statement. As I said before in the very beginning with my mother, that as someone who grew up in a very, very close-knit family, in fact, there was an extended family that lived in the same town. I actually visited my not only my mother's former home, but where my grandfather lived. I think there was this feeling that, in other words, we have roots, and those roots we have to somehow continue. So that it's the idea that what keeps us, what enables us to survive, the fact that we have very, very deep roots, and that somehow there's the sense that we've been going on for so long, that in other words, that there's something which is very, very important here that should not be lost. And at the same time, also, we have this vision and this belief that we have a destiny to fulfill. And that destiny is very much connected with the land of Israel. So that both that sense of past and that sense of future is what enables us to somehow struggle and to overcome all the difficulties of the present.
Thank you, Meir, for all those beautiful insights. And may you survive for many, many years, inspiring us, teaching us, and laughing with us. Thank you.
This Pardes Life is an original podcast production from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, please visit www.elmad.org.